We're pleased to welcome you to our last morning of Sunstone. Thank you for attending our opening session titled Shame with No Name, Identifying and Healing Aspirational Shame in Mormon Women. Before we begin, we have a few announcements. We ask that cell phones are kindly turned off and those that will be attending will be respectful and attentive. At Sunstone, we're making it a goal to build a community that allows many ways for people to express their faith. Our recent tagline is, "There's more than one way to be Mormon." We invite you to help us build a community where all paths are given space to be better understood. What this means is we all get to practice feeling challenged. At this conference, you might hear things you agree with, things that inspire you, and things that help you grow. Growth can be experienced in many ways. As you go through the conference and encounter ideas all over the spectrum of belief, we invite you to employ empathy as your standard of engagement. We're so very pleased you have decided to join us at this conference. We hope you enjoy this session and the sessions to come. The session is being recorded, and you'll be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. If you haven't already, please consider subscribing to Sunstone Magazine at the registration desk as well. Your support goes directly to keeping the symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books as well, and considering purchasing a book or two to support the Mormon Studies scholars. This session will be 60 minutes long. We ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework of that time so we can follow for the next session to start on time. As you can see from your program, this presentation description is as follows. The term aspirational shame means a common experience among Mormon women, the feeling of shame for having aspirations outside of the church's emphasis on women's roles in the home. In this session, Julie will share examples that define and illustrate the concept and will suggest ways to resolve this shame and to challenge the prevailing either and or paradigm for the life of adult women. Julie de Azevedo Hanks is a seasoned psychotherapist, owner of Wasatch Family Therapy, author of The Burnout Cure and The Assertiveness Guide for Women, media contributor, performing songwriter, blogger on Mormon cultural issues and mental health, and is passionate about cultural transformation through partnership. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you. As a performer, I just have to admit I hate being behind these things, but I guess I have too much stuff to move around, so I'll try to be animated behind here. Thank you for being here this morning. I know there are a lot of presentations to choose from, so I am really grateful that you chose to be here. Talking about something that's really personal to me, there's no objectivity in this presentation whatsoever, so I'll just kind of put that out there right now. About a year ago, I had a conversation with my dad, and I was talking to him about a lot of the things that I've been studying, researching, and writing about gender roles in Mormonism, and particularly Mormon women. And he looked at me kind of with a twinkle in his eye, and he said, "Are you sure you're not just trying to justify your life choices?" And I said, "Of course I am." And then I asked him later, I said, "I would like you to recognize the privilege of being a Mormon man and never having to justify any of your choices to anyone." And he got it. And that is an example of the shame, aspirational shame, right? Feeling like choices need to be justified culturally to other people. That is a huge burden that I've personally carried and that I know a lot of women in my clinical psychotherapy practice have dealt with and a lot of women that I've interviewed and researched. So a couple of years ago, I wrote a blog post called Healing Aspirational Shame, and I'd like to read just an excerpt from that. It wasn't until my early teens that I recognized the dilemma that I was facing. I wanted a lot for my life, for my career, for my creative expression. I knew that I wanted to pursue a helping profession, and that I wanted to express myself through songwriting and singing. But because I had internalized the message that a woman's role was to sacrifice for her family, I started believing that my aspirations were not good and not of God. I was hearing that God wanted me to be a wife and a mother, and I knew that was true, but I wanted other things for my life too. I began to wonder and eventually believe that something was wrong with me for having such strong creative desires and educational and professional aspirations. Did I have to choose between having a career and having a family? This paradox created what I call aspirational shame, the belief that my desire for achievement outside of the home meant that I was not a good woman, not a good mother, not a good wife, and not a good person. I have carried some version of aspirational shame with me for decades. So after this essay published, I had a lot of women saying, that's the thing, I have that. And so it showed me the importance of actually coming up with names for experiences so we can have a way to talk about them and to share our experience. So just an overarching definition of shame, it's an intensely painful affect resulting from exposure of the self as flawed or inferior, and a concurrent deep belief that this deficiency will result in rejection, abandonment, or loss of esteem. And I think that is the perfect definition. Though usually considered an emotion, shame can also be a cognition or belief about the self, a behavior, an evolved mechanism, so that would be like hiding, submissive behavior, or an interpersonal dynamic. For example, in my story with my father, he would be the shamer and I would be the shamed. So it can be all of these things. So for my purposes in the research that I did, I defined aspirational shame as this: the experience of being flawed coupled with the belief that you are not a good person because of desires for achievement outside of the home and family. So what triggers shame? And Brené Brown has done a lot of research on shame, and she talks about threats to ideal identity are one of the most common shame triggers. Now, in Mormonism, we have very clear ideals. So what does that mean for shame? It gets triggered a lot, because raise your hand if you match up to any ideal of any part of Mormonism. No one does. So an ideal identity is how do you want to be viewed by others and by yourself? How do you want to see yourself? I want to see myself as an engaged parent. I want to see myself as a nurturing wife, as a dedicated member of the church. Whatever those things are your ideal identities. And anything that threatens that or challenges that can be a trigger for shame. So also with ideal identities is, what are your unwanted identities? How do you not want to be viewed? I don't want to be viewed as selfish or neglectful of my family. I don't want to be viewed as greedy, right? So whenever we're viewed or we view ourselves through this lens of threats to ideal identity, shame can be triggered. So Mormonism's clear ideals can leave us very vulnerable to feelings of shame. There are 12 areas where women are particularly vulnerable to shame. And I've underlined the ones that aspirational shame in particularly hit on, and it's almost half. So body and appearance, motherhood, aspirational shame hits on, family and parenting, money and work, all of those, and then also religion, and then being stereotyped. You've heard the term the mommy wars. There's the Mormon mommy wars, right? Do you follow the prophet or do you not follow the prophet? Do you work? Do you not work? Do you work part-time or full-time? There are all these ways to divide up women's lives that pit us against each other and can trigger shame. And this is also from the work of Dr. Brené Brown. So there have been some institutional messages, and I'm going to only go back to the 70s. We could go back into the 1800s, and that's a whole different presentation. But let's look at what the messages have been over the past several decades from the institution regarding women's roles. important responsibilities are a mother has in connection with her duties as a wife, mother, homemaker, sister, sweetheart, or a good neighbor, it should be evident that these challenging responsibilities can satisfy her need to express her talents, interests, creativity, dedication, energy, and skill, which so many seek to satisfy outside the home. So summarize that for me. You got enough to do, and it should be enough, and it should satisfy you. So what does that say if it doesn't? You should be ashamed of yourself. Yeah. And again, I am not criticizing the messenger. We're just looking at the cultural message and what that does, what message that sends to women. Here's it from the next decade, 1981. It is a misguided idea that a woman should leave the home where there is a husband and children to prepare educationally and financially for an unforeseen eventuality. So in my own personal experience, I went to school and worked while I was having children and had a husband, and I really felt, and we'll talk about this later, but I felt personally inspired that that was the path that I should take. And so when you're hearing words from a prophet and that you're getting personal revelation that directly contradicts, there's a lot of tension that needs to be held there. This is also from the same talk in 1981. I mean, this one, like, I start getting, like, teary. The seeds of divorce are often sown, and the problems of children begin when mother works outside the home. You mothers should carefully count the cost before you decide to share breadwinning responsibilities with your husbands. So it's a pretty clear message there that work outside the home is not okay. Now, my mature self can say, really the message is families are important and children need to be taken care of. And how I wish it was said like that. This landmark talk to the mothers in Zion, 1987. I beg of you. So this is President Benson quoting President Kimball. I beg of you, you who would and should be bearing and rearing a family. Wives, come home from the typewriter, the laundry, the nursing. Come home from the factory, the cafe. Which is like, what about the the boardroom, the brain surgery, you know, the surgery. Anyway, no career approaches in importance of that of wife, homemaker, and mother. Cooking meals, washing dishes, making beds for one's precious husband and children. As if those are the things that define being a wife and mother. That's what I think is, like, being a wife and mother is a lot more than meals and dishes and beds. And continuing, come home, wives, to your husbands. Make home a haven for them. Come home, wives, to your children, born and unborn. Wrap the motherly cloak about you, and unembarrassed, help in a major role to create the bodies for the immortal souls who anxiously await. So the messages of the 70s and 80s, those of you who are who remember those times, there are some of you who don't, and we hate you. What's the cultural backdrop that's happening in the 70s and 80s that this is responding to, these messages are responding to? Equal rights, right? Women can do and be whatever they want to be. And so there's this underlying message of fear that somehow, if women have permission to be what they can be, that they'll neglect home and family. Which I think is so interesting because, a large number of women and children live in poverty, which means women are the ones who are actually still with the children. So they're not neglecting that. So 1995, then we get to the Family Proclamation, which is a slightly looser, more nuanced message, but only slightly. Fathers are to provide over families and are responsible to provide the necessities of life and protection for their families. Mothers are primarily responsible for the nurture of their children. Death, disability, death, and other circumstances may necessitate individual adoption. So there's kind of like an escape clause there. Like, there can be times where this can look different. And primarily responsible is not entirely responsible, so there's a little bit of flexibility compared to the messages of the previous decades. But it's still pretty clear where women should be, right? 2001, we see, as we get into the 2000s, slightly more nuanced messages, which is so exciting. But a lot of times they're to the young women. The young women are encouraged to find purpose in life, educate, study. And this is a great talk. You can now include in the dream of a woman you would like to be a picture of one qualified to serve society and make a significant contribution to the world of which she will be a part. He also says, the whole gamut of human endeavor is now open to women. So President Hinckley saying, look, there's a broader place for you in the world, which I think is such a great and healthy message. So after I wrote this blog post, I decided to hold a couple of online discussion groups and tease out kind of this aspirational shame experience for Mormon women. What does it feel like? What is it? I know my own experience, but I wanted to talk with other women. And so these are some of the themes that came out in the discussion groups. There's conflicting voices about who I'm supposed to be. I'm always questioning my choices. Am I doing the right thing? I feel like I have to explain myself. It's heavy. I feel lonely, conflicted. It's more of a quiet struggle between me and the culture of the church, not necessarily with God. I'm so afraid of being rejected, of disapproval by ward members, by God, and by my Savior for wanting a career. So those were some of the themes in the online discussion group. And then I thought, well, I signed up to present about this at Sunstone. I'm like, well, I better get some data. So I put together an online survey, and within 8 days, I had 700 responses, which I thought, if I get 50, that'll be great. That'll give me some good, you know, case examples. And I got 700 responses in a little over a week. And so I posted the link. So the survey respondents came from social media, from my Facebook profile pages, Facebook groups. And then people continued to share the sample with other women that they thought would be interested. So the sample is definitely not scientific. It's not random. It's limited to social media users. And it's women who've self-selected who are interested in the topic in order to take the time to fill out the survey. So just want to be clear that this is, you know, that's who we're talking about, women who self-selected to take care of this. But what I was surprised, even with all of that, that 70% of women answered yes to have you experienced aspirational shame. And if you take into the, maybe it's 81.6. I was surprised at actually how high that was. So I wanted to look at, are there differences in age groups, differences in experiences of aspirational shame in number of children, marital status, religious identification? And then I asked two short answer essay questions, which were, can you give me an example of aspirational shame in your life? And then what have you done, if anything, to resolve or lessen aspirational shame? And so then I looked for trends in those responses. I just think this is fascinating. This is age and aspirational shame. And if you'll notice, age 46, there's the numbers go down quite a bit from 70, 73, 74, 72 to 50%. And I haven't drilled down into, you know, I have some theories about what that means. I'm wondering if the institutional messaging that we heard earlier has something to do with it, that the 46 and above, the messaging was pretty clear, and that now we're in this transition where it's more nuanced, and so there's more tension. That's just a thought, and I would love to know any of your thoughts about why that might, 46, why aspirational shame experience would go down. And I wish I had asked, are you feeling it now? Because that then we could make sense that, okay, by 46, kids are all in school and or raised out of the house, or women have I feel like in my 40s, I'm like, I just don't care what people think anymore. I just don't have time. So any other thoughts of why that big discrepancy? Yes. Right. But I agree. I think that earlier generations, you just did what you were told to do. And as there are more and more options, there's actually that could raise the level of shame, because there's still that pretty clear message, but there's also this, but there's exceptions, and you can be whoever you want to be, but make sure you don't leave home and family. So yes, thank you so much. Any other ideas of why that might be? Yes. Daycare? Yeah.
Then I wouldn't have had that, because I'm in school all the time. I'm still home at, you know.
So you did it, if you had waited to work, you would have done it right. Like, wait till your kids are all in school, so then they're not being cared for by anyone else, and you can be home. Okay, yeah, that's a really great point. Thank you. Yeah, I like that. Any other? Yes. Helping professions are okay. Right. I love that. More career options for younger women. Women are not just funneled into helping professions that where you can have flexibility. Yeah, great. Wonderful. Yes. I like that. So 46 and above are the mothers of the younger generation. Who went? Okay, gotcha. Thank you. Yes, I love that. We're gonna move on to the next one. What I found interesting about marital status was the divorced was lower. Women who were divorced reported less aspirational shame. And I thought, well, they fit in the exception category. Like, I have to, right? I have to for financial reasons. And it's culturally sanctioned, and there's a lot of empathy. Well, of course you have to go back to school and work, because, you know, you're this single mother now. And so there's a lot of cultural empathy there. Religious identification. This is really interesting that active Mormons had a lower level of aspirational shame than former inactive or semi-active. And what I'm wondering if aspirational shame is part of what is leading women out of the church. Like, I'm not going to deal with this anymore. I'm not going to be told that I'm not okay. And so I think that's a really important, and I want to do more research on that area. Like, is this a big enough issue that women are saying, this? I'm not going to be told how I'm going to live my life, and I'm not going to feel judged and out of place anymore? So examples of aspirational shame. So these are the common bigrams. So two words that came in together frequently, stay home. So I think it would be stay home and then home mother, so stay at home mother. Graduate school, aspirational shame, feel guilty. So this is just kind of interesting to see which words showed up together. Lots of law school, medical school, graduate school. Examples in the essays, just a few. Going back to school and work after being a stay-at-home mom for many years, receiving comments whether it's worth it because apparently my kids are suffering. Also lots of small passive-aggressive comments. So these are examples of aspirational shame. I am regularly told not to love my job too much because it might impede my ability to marry. It seems basically assumed by most people I talk to that my career is a threat to marriage and or something I will obviously abandon when, not if, I marry. And marriage is assumed to be something that I want. I always felt like if I love my work, then I might not be doing it right with my family. I also had parents who wanted me to go to college but were disappointed when I graduated and wasn't married yet. They were even more disappointed when I decided to go to graduate school and wasn't married. I was frequently told while dating as a teen and young adult that I shouldn't talk about wanting a PhD because it was too intimidating. I was often told that college and careers weren't important or were only important as fallback jobs because being a wife and a mother was my main task. I feel guilty for wanting to pursue theater and music because it would take me away from my family, but would also be unlikely to bring a steady paycheck. It feels wrong to want something so much when it won't directly benefit everyone around me. These just make me so sad. Okay, so the second essay question is, what have you done to lessen or resolve aspirational shame? So the four most common words in the was church, God, support, and women. Number one word associated with church, leave. That's what women are doing to lessen aspirational shame. God and path. So they're either leaving or they're saying, what is God's path for me? They're claiming that personal authority and personal revelation. Support and husband were the top two words there. And then Mormon woman, talking, strong Mormon woman. So we'll get to some of these and mine them a little bit more. So just kind of the themes in this second essay question were, again, leave the church or focus on God's personal plan, choosing a supportive husband and family, having strong female role models who are both wives and mothers and in school and or working, talking with other women about shame, and then therapy was mentioned multiple times, counseling, going to therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, which I'm like, good for you for going to therapy. I've seen a lot of you in my office. Okay, so here are some little samplings of comments regarding leaving the church and how that has lessened aspirational shame. I've become less active. Leaving the church was the only way to make me feel whole. Sadly, taking a step back and reducing my activity level has helped me and my daughters reject any guilt and shame. Getting the hell out of Mormonism and seeing that women don't have to fit in a box. I left the church. I'm no longer subjecting myself to listen to church leaders or lessons. I have cut off contact with most of my extended family after warning me multiple times to stop insulting me. And under the theme of focusing on God's personal path and personal revelation, I decided to focus on God's plan for me. I'm reminded of the spiritual promptings I've had that this is the path that I should pursue. I'm finally accepting my gifts and talents. My patriarchal blessing encourages me to study and to fulfill my desires. A greater understanding of each individual's ability to choose a path that is right for them and their family and in alignment with God's plan for them. So the idea of agency came up a lot. Like, this is my path. This is my choice. I love and live the gospel exclusively for myself and not for others. My firm belief in personal revelation and a firm belief that no one else can receive revelation for me. I mean, that's a big one right there. Reclaiming, and in a lot of the stories, I heard this movement from the external authority to internal authority, which I think is really exciting and really important. Supportive husband and family, that was mentioned a lot. So aspirational shame goes down if you're married to somebody who's cheering you on. And I am blessed to have a husband who has, over the years, learned to become more and more supportive. Don't think he knew what he was getting into, and I guess nobody does. My husband is incredibly supportive of my role as an entrepreneur and businesswoman. He has encouraged me and helps me visualize a future in my business and allows me and that allows our family to fully enjoy the good things of life. My husband is encouraging. Also, in the examples of aspirational shame, there were lots of comments about that family members made that triggered aspirational shame. So whether spouse and immediate family or extended family are supportive or whether they're critical is a big factor in the experience of aspirational shame. Strong female role models. I think talking about these issues with other Mormon women made the biggest difference. Watching other women who are both wives and mothers. As I get older, I'm exposed to different people and friends, specifically powerful and accomplished Mormon women. Another theme, talking with other women. The Aspiring Mormon Women Discussion Board and getting to know more faithful working LDS mothers. Talking with other Mormon women and men about aspirations helps me recognize I'm not alone. Becoming friends. So developing this support, so people that you can look up to and then also people that you can talk with is really critical in reducing aspirational shame. Going to therapy, learning boundaries and going to therapy, marriage counseling, years of therapy. So recommendations. Based on the findings of this survey, we really need, particularly with young women, to emphasize personal revelation and agency over emphasizing gender roles. And what's interesting is there are just as many talks about personal revelation and agency as there are about gender roles. I mean, there are lots of talks, but we seem to focus on the gender roles, and I want to challenge all of us here to really highlight and focus on the personal revelation aspect, because we are the ones. So the institutional messaging we can't really change, but we can change what we focus on and what we talk about, and that's the culture. That's the cultural change that can happen. And we have a say. Seeking a partner who is supportive. So if you have young women, young adult women, talking about the importance of selecting a partner who's going to support you, not just financially, but who's going to support you in becoming who you want to be and supporting your aspirations. I've heard so many women say, you know, I want to go to medical school, but I don't tell anybody because my family is so discouraging, or the men that I'm dating are threatened or say, well, how can you be a mother and go to medical school? And, you know, I always like to flip things around and say, well, would you ask a man that? How can you be married and go to medical school? How can you have children and be a doctor? That's just going to be way too stressful for you. So if you turn it around, it really highlights the assumptions that we often make. Reaching out to LDS female mentors. And I'm part of an organization called Aspiring Mormon Women that was actually mentioned in one of the comments, or several of the comments. But that's a great place where they match up professional women with aspiring professional women in the same field, and you can have discussions, and it's just been a really fun resource. So online support groups, those are great. And I know Danielle has developed a support group for education, women in education. So there are a lot of options in person, or if you don't have them in person, to find online support groups and encourage women around you to find like-minded women. Another important aspect of reducing aspirational shame is to reframe that either or to both and. And in my essay, I call it I Refuse to Choose. Growing up in the 70s and 80s, I saw that it was this either or, and I just rejected that paradigm. I just thought, that's not creative enough for me. I'm much more creative than that, and there has to be another way. So in our conversations with our family members and friends, to use that both and. So how can you do both instead of feeling like you have to choose one or the other? And I was talking with a younger woman, a neighbor, she has many children, and we were talking about our choices, and she said to me, she just said, I had no idea that both and was a choice. I saw my mother working 60 hours a week, and I decided, well, I didn't want that, so my only choice was this. And I think having those conversations where, no, there's so, especially with the internet, there's so much flexibility to job sharing, flexible work time. Most of the work that I do now is online. I do coaching through Skype. I do consulting on the phone. So there are lots of creative ways to... I did a distance PhD program. I mean, it just amazing opportunities that create that both and. I think one large aspect of this, because we hear a lot, women, you can do anything you can be anything you want to be. That needs to be balanced with the message to men and to young men that you can take on home responsibilities. Sharing parenting, this is our home. These are our children. This is not just my job, your job, but we are a partnership. And we don't hear that message enough, and that has to happen equally as we speak about empowering women to create the choices and the life that they want. We need to be doing that with men. That you being an engaged father is really important. This is, you know, this is your laundry too. encouraging and expecting men to participate equally. Dr. Brené Brown developed 4 steps to shame resilience that go along with what we're talking about today. And the first one is recognizing when you're feeling shame. So if you're feeling aspirational shame, labeling it and saying, oh, I'm feeling shame about how much I want for my life and what I want to do. Understand its triggers. So that might be, I'm told through the institutional messaging and people around me that I should want this. Ideally, I should be a stay-at-home mother, but that's not the ideal identity that I want. My ideal identity is to have both. The second is practicing critical awareness, or recognizing that shame is normal. Everyone experiences shame of some kind or another on a regular basis, and that shame is a human experience, that you're not unique in your experience of shame. And one thing that was so healing for me in writing this essay was hearing that reflected back to me, having other women say, I've had that experience. I totally know what you mean. For me, that validated, like, okay, I'm not alone. This is a normal experience. A lot of women are experiencing this. And it helped me to put it in a bigger picture. The third step for developing shame resilience is reach out to trusted relationships for support. And trusted relationships, I think, is important. It's easy to talk about things that are important to us with people that we don't trust, and we're not going to get the response and the support that we need. And so making sure that person has earned the right to hear your story is really important. And the fourth step is tell our stories and share shame with someone we trust to respond compassionately and empathetically. Empathy is the antidote to shame. I love that. So if someone is sharing shame with you, respond with empathy. And that is how we combat how we combat shame. And again, that's from Brené Brown's work on shame. So we can open it up for questions and discussions now. Thank you so much for listening, and let's have some questions. Thank you. Questions or comments? Yes. Yes, hold on just a minute, because we want to make sure we can hear you. This one?
This one is.
Oh, that's okay. No, that's what we want, because we want it on the audio. And then just speak loudly so everybody can hear you. No, it's going into the audio, so just speak loud for us.
I am one who grew up during the ERA period and felt a lot of shame. I internalized all of these messages, and now that I'm only 70, I regret that I didn't break out more strongly. But at the age of about 40, I was divorced with four teenage children and started a career with no preparation at all. In 1995, I was teaching a Relief Society social relations lesson. This is how I got released from Relief Society. The social relations lesson was called Social Challenges Facing the LDS Woman. And I looked at it and it was greed, selfishness, and divorce was the list that I was supposed to talk about. And
well,
example of aspirational shame. Yeah. You know, the guilt that was just sort of poured on women my age.
Yeah.
Really, really difficult.
Well, and then the shame of being released for talking about the actual social issues.
Yeah, but I had a really good bishop and he called me in as gospel doctor.
Okay. So yeah, promotion, right? I love that.
Who knew?
All right. Yes. Why don't you come up and speak right here so we can get both.
First, thank you for this presentation. It was really helpful. I'm really curious. I guess this isn't necessarily a question, but I've got two adult daughters who are recently returned missionaries. So they're part of that recent movement, right? And I'm wondering, it'll be really interesting to watch that over the next decade, because I feel like one of the side effects of that is they get very infused with the institutional program while they do that, right? And so I'm a little concerned as a parent. It kind of almost feels like a bit of a step backward with them. I mean, great that they went out and served a mission, but also they came back very, you know, programmed, you know,
so.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. Great question.
Yeah, thank you for that. I hadn't thought about that because my thinking has been, well, they're going out and they're being leaders in the church and they're, but with that also comes the programming that you're talking about, the messaging that's, so I would say you have a huge impact as a father in supporting them on their personal journey. What are your dreams and goals? What are your, and not buying into that either or. not pushing them one way or the other, but letting them find their own way. I think, and then finding female, like a variety of female role models is really important. And helping, you know, if there's anything you can do to hook, if they're interested in, you know, engineering or nursing or whatever, helping them hook up with active LDS women who are doing those things, I think can be really powerful.
I'm worried about my younger daughter. She just got married and dropped out of school.
Yeah, and it's so hard because you want to support that, right? Being a mom is great, and it's not a career. Like, you cannot support yourself. You can't, you know, it's a worthwhile endeavor, and it's among the most important work you can do. But I, as a parent, I would say, you know what, that is a great thing to do, and it's not a career. So what are you going to, you know, how are you going to prepare yourself for adult life? Yeah, great question. Yes. Yeah, come on up.
Behind here and ask my question. This is going to sound really pathetic, but I kind of need to go a step back. I was raised on a robust diet of those quotes that you shared. I was taught explicitly that women that worked outside of the home were selfish and lacked faith. So if your wings are clipped that early, if by elementary school you're thinking, like I remember thinking, I'd love to be an astronaut, but that's not going to work for motherhood, so I can't do that. Oh, being a ballerina would be fun. You can't be pregnant and be a ballerina, so that's not going to work. Medical school would take too long. All of those things were shut down. So how do you have aspirations if you've been trained to not want things for so long? How do you even go back to wanting things to begin with? Because I'm at the point now where my youngest is about to start school. I have no idea what I want. I stopped wanting things a long time ago. So I see heads shaking, so I hope I'm not the only hot mess in the room. But how do you want things again?
Yeah. Oh, thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I think one of the best strategies. Thank you for sharing that. That was really powerful. And like, I'm very emotional hearing about that. Is go back to those things that you dreamed of, and some of those things, like you really. It's really impossible to become a ballerina if you haven't been training up until this point, right? But there are things that you can do and interests that you have. So I would go back and revisit those things that you were passionate about as a child. So astronaut, you know, aeroscience. I mean, what you can study those things now. Like, those are actual possibilities now. And go back and really reconnect with that little girl who could dream and who had dreams, and kind of follow those threads. And it may just be, oh, taking a few science classes and just testing it out, but I would go back to that, the time when you did feel that passion. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah, that breaks my heart to hear you say, how do you get back to wanting something again? Want whatever you want. But I was thinking about something that happened recently. This young person who's really dear to me, and for years she's talked about working her way to pursuing a PhD. And it's just something I've loved hearing her talk about. And then she was at a certain point where she was either going to pursue applications or stop. And I just assumed she was going to tell me about these great applications she was preparing. And she goes, well, if I can do that. And you know, we were just doing something and everything. It just stopped me cold. And I said, if? And she said, well, maybe I'm not supposed to be doing this. And I looked, and it was really hard for me not to shame her. But I just said, well, one, you can do anything you want to do. You are someone who makes the world happen. You can do anything you want to do if you want to do it. So again, you know, just reminding her, I'm not telling you have to, but of course you can do this. And apparently, I didn't know that, but apparently she was hearing from people, and they weren't even people in the church. Her friends in the church were just, raw, go. These happened to be people outside the church. So again, this is a human thing. And I kind of tried to explore to find out, is someone pressuring, you know? And it was really crucial. She told me later it was really crucial that she hear that from me. Just this reminder. If you want it, you can do it. And I think we forget how it is that we really nurture each other. It's not a matter of birthing someone. It's a matter of inspiring someone. And I think part of the shame aspect is this conversation we've had for so long that the only way we really can be a mother is to bear children, whereas the most essential thing about nurturing is for everybody, men and women and everything, is to inspire people. And you can do that no matter what your career or job or occupation or anything. The inspiring people to live is the essential part. So maybe if we kind of look at, no matter what I do, I can inspire people. No matter how old I am, how young I am, I can inspire people, and then see how that can fit into what will work. But I think I've been surprised to see the different ways just saying one thing could make a difference. She was ready to just stop, not even do anything. And now she's headed off to her doctoral program now. So you never know.
Yes, come on up. While you're coming up, I just want to say what you want matters. And I just assume that what I want is good. And so I want to encourage you, what you want is good.
Kind of in line with that last comment, I just want to talk about the importance of mothers and the influence that they have. In saying that, you have to know my mom. She was, for example, the first woman party chairman of the Democratic Party in Weber County. She was in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment when it was not popular to be in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment. She was very much a feminist, very much a strong liberal Democrat. It rubbed off on me, as you can tell by the T-shirt. And she taught her daughters that they could be anything they want to, and that they should pursue what they want, and that they should pursue her dreams. And just as importantly, she taught her sons to teach their daughters that, and to treat their wives that way. And so my brothers and I have tried to do that. I'm sure that my wife could tell you about times when I haven't done it as perfectly as I should. But it's so important. And so these things that you talked about really resonated to me, like the both and. My mother taught me that. You can be a faithful member of the church and be a liberal that thinks differently, that thinks outside the box, that does things differently. You can be both, and you can reach for your dreams. And she was just wonderful, and I'm so grateful for a mother that taught me that. And so I just wanted to give that message of how important it is for mothers today to teach those things to their kids. Because if you do that, the blessings, literal blessings you can give to your children are beyond count, both to the boys and the girls.
Yes, come on up. Yeah.
I just kind of wanted to share my own, what I consider a personal success story. I was one of those in college. You know, you grow up and they tell you can be anything you want to be, but is not really true, right? When I was in college, I took a geology class, and it was my favorite class ever. And that's what I wanted to do. I loved science, but my mom especially and other people kept saying, well, you got to choose something that, you know, you can have a family with, like, you know, do business, and then you can be a secretary or a paralegal, or maybe you can get a teaching, you know, degree and teach for a few years. And you know what? I failed accounting. It sucked. I failed econ because it sucked. But I ended up graduating basically in general studies and put it on the back burner. And so years later, after I had kids and everything, I experienced a lot of depression, which I still struggle with. But my husband encouraged me to go back to school. And he said, you know, why don't you study something you want to study? Take classes, do something. And I did, and I took chemistry classes. He's a chemist. And I loved it. And I found a part-time job that luckily is flexible because I have two daughters that, you know, were little at the time still and are now in school during the day. But I've been at my job for 4 years now. I'm a chemistry lab technician, and I love it. And someday, you know, down the road, I'd love to have a full-time, you know, chemist job. But you know what? To me, that's kind of a success story because of what I was told. And I went back, and the support of my husband was great. And it's, yeah. I don't know. Just kind of a success story, I feel.
Okay, I'm not sure about this question, but this topic resonates with me as well, and I work as an attorney, but I feel like I'm in a situation where I don't have to work because of my husband's job, and it's hard for me to explain that to the people in my ward because I feel like I lose Mormon credibility. So I find myself saying, but it's only part-time, because I have three small children at home still, none of them in school. And, or I'll say, but I mean, I have mental health issues or bad postpartum in the first year, so I really need this. And I hate that I feel like I have to explain to people why I choose to work when the truth is that I love what I do. And I love being away from the children, too. So I don't know. And I don't know if it's a confidence thing or I just have to get more comfortable with being judged or what, but I can't just say, or I don't at this time just say, I work because I love my job and what I do. I say, but it's only part-time.
So how do you own that, right? How do you, that's a great question.
We are ruthless with each other. Like the questions and the assumptions that it just makes me so angry because you shouldn't have to justify, right? Yeah. Saying, I work because that's what God wants me to do, will shut everybody up. Seriously. Like, if you just say, I'm doing what God wants me to do, this is the right path for me, nobody's going to question that. And I'm just so angry that we feel, as women, like we even have to justify. And I've found myself doing that a lot, too. Well, it's part-time. Well, I have flexibility. Well, da-da-da. Well, you know, I'm mostly home. Well, And it's just like, why do we have to do that dance? My dad, like in the beginning, he didn't have to do that dance, right? Why do I have to do that dance? So I think that's a great way to end on that challenge for all of us to own our decisions, to not feel like we have to give anyone an explanation for why we're doing what we're doing. That's the beauty of agency. That's the beauty of personal revelation and individual path, is that we are doing what God wants us to do, and that's the end of the story, and we don't owe anyone an explanation. So thank you again for being here today. It was enjoyable. Thank you.